Hello, I'm Eliza Morgan.
And I'm Martin Thomas, your host today on The Hatch, a regular podcast which talks with people who are affecting change for the better. We believe that our industry deserves better, better attitude, better ideas, better integrity, and better outcomes. The Hatch incubates emotions, ideas, beliefs, and possibilities from awesome people, and we welcome you. Today's awesome guest is Simon Newstead. Simon is the founder of Bite Society, a mission-driven, zero-profit vegan food project with the goal to make tasty and affordable treats and help inspire other vegan founders with their own projects. Simon is also a co-founder of Frenzoo, a mobile game studio in Hong Kong, founded in 2008. In addition, he's an angel investor and supporter of other companies, including Ocean Hugger Foods, Sheok Meats, Kinds of Grace, and Hungry Planet. Simon, thank you ever so much for joining us today. It's a massive pleasure to have you here. You seem to be one of the busiest individuals I seem to have come across. So we really value your time and energy that you can join us today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for inviting me on. I'm excited to be here.
Excellent, excellent. The intention for starting the Bite Society was to lower the prices so that more people could afford vegan chocolate, because we'll talk about why vegan products are premium price, which seems ridiculous. We'll get to that.
Right.
And also, as importantly, if not more importantly, to inspire others to follow your path through the learnings and mistakes and successes that you've had along the way. And you even have a dedicated webpage to help others along that, which I love that. So all congratulations. So we've been following your journey via the Bite Society podcast and blog posts, which is why your voice is so familiar. You have taken us through from the first notion of the idea to naming, branding, product, manufacturing, sampling, distribution, and retail. It's the most transparent process of taking a product to market that I'm aware of. Why is such transparency important to you? And what reaction have you received from this approach?
Right. So we decided to do it very transparently for a couple of reasons. One is that we could go and use it as a way to share people the journey and tell them that, hey, starting a vegan project, even if you're not in the food industry, is definitely doable. Mm-hmm. It's not something that you have to be an expert and a veteran for 20 years working in the field to consider. And, you know, I'm a mission-driven guy, and I'm trying to do this for, you know, to go and spread vegan food and make it as affordable as possible.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to kind of do the transparency approach to encourage people to start something themselves, whether it's within an existing organization or their own project or a startup idea themselves. And it's actually funny, through the process of doing this, my wife actually started her own vegan company.
No way.
You know, through helping me out, Grace, who's on the podcast, she was, you know, helping out with, you know, sourcing potential factories and manufacturing for the vegan chocolates. And she said, hey, this is kind of fun and I'm enjoying this process. Mm-hmm. So she decided to start a vegan fashion company.
Excellent.
And so that's kind of happening in parallel to my project, and we help each other out on the projects. So close to home, that's an example of what I would ultimately like to do with this project, which is to kind of help and inspire a bunch of other people to kind of get involved and do their own projects or jump in and support existing projects.
I was reading a post about Stella McCartney and her Adidas tracksuits. Did you see that, whereby she... they can be recycled simply by soaking them, and they just disintegrate, and thus can be repurposed and reused. So is it along those lines that Grace...
My wife's actually doing a vegan kind of accessory approach. So she's working with, for example, like Pinatex, which is a pineapple leather, which is a very sustainable and cruelty-free, of course, approach, as well as other materials. So, yeah, I think that... vegan fashion innovation is very exciting. I've kind of got my eye on that.
Yes.
And that's, I think that will follow vegan food, you know, which is going through a huge kind of development stage now. I think that will also happen in fashion and other industries.
I think food is possibly the forerunner of more elements to come. And it's a very exciting time to be alive in that zone.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
For us, one of the most exciting aspects of your marketing approach stems from the very culture of Bite Society. Your culture is so important. which we might define as fulfilling a need,
right,
as opposed to selling products. Mm. And that's a really interesting dichotomy that a lot of companies, you know, like empirical companies, they produce products or services and then they try and sell them, but you're fulfilling a need. This in turn has energized influencers into getting behind you and generating loyalty from like-minded people, resulting in what we'd call humanized growth, which is permission to grow from the customers and from the community. You know, you have been given permission to grow because people are supporting you. So as a zero profit plant-based company, that's quite a mouthful. I love it. Zero profit based plant-based company. Awesome. Was this always your hopeful intention, or has it just turned out this way?
I think it was pretty deliberate, actually. Mm. So we started with the goal of like lowering the cost of vegan foods and trying to be transparent and use it as a case study.
Yes.
And so we're like, well, how can we do that? I mean, how can we lower the cost? And one of the things that I thought about was, well, traditionally in a company, you're going to have a lot of, you know, marketing, branding, sales costs, whether it's expensive, you know, sales teams through to ad budgets, through to, you know, promotional spend, events, et cetera, et cetera. And the thought is like, what if we had a no marketing budget? Like, how would that affect the pricing of this product? Mm. And it turns out like, well, that actually makes it very competitive. Like, I think right now our chocolate bar is probably the cheapest in Australia, like vegan chocolate bar available in retail, Milky chocolate bar.
Yeah, I saw it at $1.99 the other day in Ormond Road.
Right. Yeah. $1.99 and some places are down to $1.50, wow. which is really unheard of in the vegan
completely.
Kind of milk chocolate space.
Yeah.
So having no marketing spend is great, but then how do you get the word out? And that's kind of the challenge. And so that ties in nicely to the whole transparency approach and people getting on board because they're like, hey, this is, you know, I see this is mission driven. This is not designed to go and just, you know, line people's pockets and make people, you know, the founders rich. This has a different, you know, purpose to the project. Mm. And I think people like to get involved with that. You know, they like to, you know, these days people are conscious consumers. They want to get involved with brands and missions that they support.
Yes.
And, you know, you still got to have a good product and it's got to be, you know, meet a sort of minimum quality threshold. But I think people want to, you know, vote with their dollars and vote with their kind of mind share to, you know, support these good projects. And, you know, so far so good. I mean, definitely it has challenges. I won't, you know.
We've traveled with you with the challenges,
right?
Yes,
absolutely. I mean, you know, that is a challenge. I see. Yeah. I wouldn't call them my competitors because we're all in this together. More vegan foods, the better. Mm. But other companies who have budgets and are doing, you know, sponsored Facebook posts, they get, you know, hundreds of, you know, comments and,
of course,
you know, TV advertising and so forth. And I see, you know, billboards even for some other brands. And that's fine. So we do have that kind of disadvantage of not being able to do the marketing, but it's an interesting challenge to take the other approach.
I see it less as a disadvantage and more as an opportunity because if you follow the thoughts of someone like Seth Godin, who talks less about mass marketing and more about reaching a viable number of people,
right.
And I'd argue that you've reached a viable number of people and you've lit the touch paper. You and a few others have lit the touch paper, like BC, for example, Botanical Cuisine, Omid from there. And it's just fired up people's, they're voting with their wallets.
I think so. I mean, I do like his thing about, you know, have 100 true fans rather than, you know, 1,000 kind of meh, you know.
Yeah.
It's like whatever, I do like that approach. And I think one thing that's kind of reassuring in the back of my mind is, like, the goal of this company is not to go and sell a whole lot of chocolate. And, you know, it's not to be the world's number one chocolate. You know, I hope it can build up a thriving, you know, a thriving success story in its own right. But the real goal of this project is to be a case study, and it's to be an open case study that hopefully will help a lot more people. And that's really the goal. So we don't need to be, you know, a huge scale. You know, we just need to be, an operating kind of, you know, successful company, but we don't necessarily need to be, you know, taking over the world and being the number one and everything. And so I think that's also a bit of reassurance to me personally, because
It takes the heat off a little bit, doesn't it? Because you know you're starting from the right place, and what will be,
right. Mm. And I said that right from the start of the podcast. Is like, you know, most, and I'm in, you know, I don't have any kind of like, you know, rose colored glasses on. Like, you know, most startups fail, most businesses fail, and I know because I've started businesses that have failed before. And so, you know, once you take that pressure off and say, look, we're doing it for the right reasons and we're doing it in a very open, transparent way. And even if we fail, there'll be learnings that will be useful for other people.
Yep.
I think then that's kind of, you know, so it takes all the pressure off, and then I can just go out and do my thing and face the challenges without adding extra mental load to myself.
With shareholders and stakeholders and whatever holders.
That's right.
I know that now you've been in a retail distribution environment for 6 months, about right?
Yeah, just under 6 months.
Just under 6 months. Yeah. And in that time, you have distribution in 7 states and New Zealand.
Yes, and Hong Kong as well.
And Hong Kong, of course, Hong Kong.
That's Hong Kong, and we're about to launch into online into China as well. So that's
right.
That's exciting.
Which is kind of interesting because I was wryly amused by the fact that you had to sell the concept of vegan chocolate to the factory,
right?
As a thing,
yeah.
That they didn't get, because remember that first response you got from the factory was like, we don't know what you're trying to do here. And they hit you with massive minimum order quantities and inflated prices, and you had to go over there. And it was only when you met them face to face that you were able to explain the trajectory of veganism or plant-based consumption. And they went, oh, okay, yeah, maybe there's something in this.
That's right. And that was an interesting challenge. I mean, you know, we're kind of fortunate here in Melbourne that, you know, Melbourne is one of the fastest growing vegan markets in the world. You know, I'm sure, you know, you've got lots of friends who are vegan and, you know, and many people follow a vegan, you know, diet. But we're like a, you know, an outlier, you know, in the whole world. And if you look at the entire world, veganism is still a very, very nascent concept. And it's only a very small niche. I would argue it's probably only a couple of percent in the world. Mm. Apart from maybe India, traditionally for religious reasons, some people may be vegan.
Sure.
But I think that, so going over to a co-packer, and these are, you know, companies that manufacture millions and millions of units for the largest companies in the world, they, you know, they hadn't heard of this term. And so it was a struggle. And it took a bit of time and it took myself and Grace to kind of convince them to get on board. But now that we're working together and we just placed the second order for the second manufacturing run. The relationship is really good. So they're kind of, you know, actively working together, and we're just about to introduce a new flavor that we kind of work together on, which is a salted caramel skew.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it did take a bit of time, but to their credit, you know, they and we're talking to other co-packers for other potential products as well. They're open-minded once it's explained to them. It just needs someone to take the time to, you know, help them through it.
To that end, it would have been a massive benefit to have a Hong Kong footprint. I'm not calling Grace a Hong Kong footprint, but to have a partner like Grace and you know, the associated friends and contacts and et cetera. That seemed like a massive benefit at the time. If it was just, say, myself starting in little old Melbourne with no footprint there, I mean, still achievable now, thanks to you, but it would have been a much higher hill to climb.
I think you're right in some regards. I absolutely...
Well, we won't know, will we?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I would say that, you know, definitely having Grace, my wife, kind of, you know, speaking the language and talking to the factory. I mean, their English is okay, but, you know, sometimes having the native language conversations, like, helped to build the initial relationship. And then going over and meeting in person, obviously, was the next big step.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing. And actually, we're thinking about other products because... that's some advantage or something that we can leverage. And
so absolutely.
If there's great manufacturing capability, you know, ethical kind of, you know, top quality international producers, and we can bridge the gap between the, you know, the language barrier and to go and take those products out to, you know, to other audiences in other countries.
Well, you've cut the channel. You've created the avenue of opportunity. Now it's just you can just bolt things on at the end, and distribution is distribution. You've got the brand.
I think so, yeah.
You know.
And I was just having a chat to one of my collaborators, Mikhail, who handles the international for this project, where, yeah, we've kind of like introduced it. We've got the brand, Bite Society, and we've got an initial set of retailers. I think we're in kind of something like 70, 80 physical stores. And, you know, that's good enough to go on, you know, introduce new products in the future.
It's
refreshing to hear you said earlier that, you know, you're all in this together with other brands. You know, the more vegan products, the better.
Yeah.
Which is so nice as a consumer to hear. You know, you're not out there to compete against your other brands. You want as many vegan products on the shelves as possible for consumers.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny. Like in the very early days, I was having a discussion with you know, one of the I bounced this idea off a lot of people to kind of like just kind of, you know, see what people thought as I went in the early days. And someone said, hey, but if you're doing it so openly and transparently, what happens if someone like a Mars or a, you know, or a Cadbury comes along and says, hey, I'm going to go and do that. And they go and put you out of business because they do a, you know, a crunchy rice chock ball, you know, a vegan one. And they've got economies of scale even beyond what our factory could do and the prices and stuff. And I said, you know, that would be great. My job is done. If I can go and have like vegan chocolates affordable in all of the supermarkets around the world, you know, ultimately, then that's kind of mission accomplished from my point of view. So I actually don't see, although naturally, you know, you're a, you know, sort of competitive person, you know, you see people come out, your initial reaction maybe is like, oh, competitor. But 2 minutes later, it's like, oh, that's fantastic. You know, just more options. So I just love how there's, you know, more and more products coming out from both small startups, local startups, as well as from larger, you know, mega corporations.
For sure. We were particularly taken with the avalanche of new information and hurdles you had to absorb and overcome. Because you're an engineer at
by training.
So many a person would have thrown in the towel, particularly when it comes to dealing with the factory in China, which we've talked on regarding ingredients and that first minimum order quantity of 4.5 tons.
Right.
Your voice changed timber when we. It was quite funny. But more recently, like the new barcodes for the salted caramel and that sort of. And then, but I was looking at all the responses you got going, they're idiots. They could do it in 3 minutes. And it gives you, it may not solve the problem, but it does actually give you some kind of resonance in terms of understanding that there are ways around that. And the hope levels sort of stay up. And I really, really like that. So in many ways, you had to sell that concept of vegan chocolate. So this whole process, I imagine it's been quite cathartic for you.
Yeah, I think
you're not on your own, are you?
Yeah, exactly. I think that, well, it's a funny one. It's definitely cathartic from the point of view that I can just go and say, oh, you know, things are not working well and this is going badly. And it's always good to go and talk and have friends listen. And I consider, you know, the people who support our project, you know, are definitely friends of the project and supporters. So I think that's definitely, you know, useful to go and have a bit of a, you know, sharing of the problems and just, you know, and sometimes people will help. Like sometimes people will say, I had a couple of people come and say, hey, you can get barcodes this way. And this is like not the official channel, but this is another way that will work in practice. So sometimes it's useful for that. I would say, you know, to counter that on the flip side, being transparent is what we will do and will continue to do. We won't ever change that. But it is, there are negatives. There are negatives in that, for example, you know, I may be talking to a potential large retailer. And they may go and see something has gone wrong or something's not as good. And they may lose confidence because this is not normal. It's not normal in business for companies to admit, you know, failures and, you know, weaknesses and defeats. Like, I'll be the first to tell you, like, do I think our product could be better? Absolutely. I don't think it's as good as it could be or needs to be. But, you know, some people seeing that, you know, in business, it's all this fake it till you make it. Everything's perfect.
100%.
And I understand that. I totally get that. So being transparent, not everyone will be, you know, understanding of it. But I think that, you know, like I said, like bigger picture, even if we lose 30% of business because we're transparent, still like our impact can be, you know, significant because we're trying to be a case study. We're not trying to sell chocolates.
And you still have this viable number of people who are with you.
Yep.
Brand loyalty. You know, you'll get the loyalty of consumers who are on the journey with you will really appreciate the transparency that you give.
Yeah, I think so. I think that that helps as long as you have a minimum price. Like, that's an interesting one. I had a conversation with someone who works in marketing at Thank You.
Yeah.
So the social good company.
Yeah. We've worked with them.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. I have so much appreciation for what they do and their mission and how they're set up. And he made a point and he said, people will love your mission, but the product has to, you know, meet a certain threshold. It's got to be a great product to sell a great cause. And that's a challenging one because what if the product is good, but the cause is really important? And are you going to, you know, are people going to be let down and being like that? But then it comes back to the, well, if that's the case, then, you know, be open about it and be open about trying to improve it.
Yeah.
And even if you can't improve it, like at least you go and say, hey, it is what it is. And you know, I love my chocolate. I eat it and I eat too much of it sometimes, but I know that not everyone, you know, would like it. And I've done a lot of surveys and polls and I know that, you know, like 60, 70% of people enjoy it in a blind taste test, but not everyone does, not 100%.
No, sure.
So I think, yeah, it's pros and cons, but definitely this project, you know, we're going to just go and lay it out there and it is what it is and we'll be open and trying to improve
And to Eliza's point, it's brand loyalty, but it's also purpose loyalty.
Right.
And that's probably a bigger catchment than just the brand itself. I mean, I noticed on Insta, I think it is, that you were asking people what new categories, what new non-chocolate categories could be explored. And a whole range of things came back. Some of them were still chocolate, of course, because, you know, you get that. But, you know, I really like the idea of a box of assorted vegan chocolates a la Roses or Dairy Milk or whatever, because there aren't too many of those anyway.
Right.
And someone even said, I like those shells. Remember those guilas? Yes. I can't even say it. There, anyway, enough of that. So I think that's interesting. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about what other categories do you think could be explored. And I noticed that you've now got distribution in, I'm going to kill myself for forgetting this, but they had a vegan alcohol bottle shop.
Sibling.
And I thought, well, there's a whole new category because, to my understanding, there's only one mass-produced beer which is vegan, which is Cooper's Green.
Right.
To my understanding.
Yep.
So I'm not. I think there's a bit of egg or a bit of dairy in most wines and beers.
Yeah.
That's my
In the production process.
In the production process. I'm not sure why they need to be there. I'm sure they'll find a good reason. But what other categories or what category zones are you toying with?
Well, that's a great question. So I'm at the moment. Thinking about the project is food and beverage oriented.
Sure.
Because the reason why is because the vast majority of the animal consumption and suffering is coming from the food industry that dwarfs other things like, you know, medical testing or, you know, entertainment or other things. And so it's food. And I think for food, like, I'm looking at anything which is has a problem where the prices are too high and there's not enough viable kind of like affordable alternatives and technology wise we can accomplish it. So for example, like some things are done pretty well already. So I wouldn't go into like, you know, what's a good example? Like
milk?
Yeah.
Milk, perfect example. Yeah. Mm. There's affordable soy milks already today on the market. In fact, I go to Woolies and Coles and I did a measurement the other day because I like to go on.
Oh, you love your measurements. I love it when you went around there. And you looked at the Cadbury range and went, okay, well, that's what I'm up against there. And then you saw there was so much Malteser action. You thought, well, I'll have a crack at that.
Yeah.
So I like that. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and that's the way to see what's really going on. You just go and measure the shelf space.
Yeah.
These companies are masters of understanding what people are buying and they assign their shelf spaces accordingly. And perfect example is plant milks have really done well, and I think they've become mainstream. And the figures that we've seen are, you know, it's well over 10%. It's like 15% of the market now. Mm. And I would guess in Melbourne it's probably, you know, accelerating beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
More than half of Australian households, you know, consume plant-based milks. And they may have dairy as well, some of them, a lot of them.
Yep.
But, you know, it's definitely going up. So we're not going to go and do categories which are already, you know, the demands have been met pretty well from both kind of like high-end exotic boutique brands right through to kind of like everyday, you know, ones. But are there other ones that, you know, there aren't enough options or the options are too expensive? Yeah, I think there's a lot. And so we're looking at other things which are, I'm also looking at like logistics because we're trying to keep our costs down. Other things that are temperature stable, like ambient, I can store them no matter what the temperature is. I can store them. They have a long shelf life. Hopefully not so heavy, so I can go and shift things around and try to expand globally.
I've got one for you.
Sure.
Because I go to a place called Herbivore in Chapel Street.
Right.
And they have pockets of, you know, falafels and nice stuff.
Yes.
But they're struggling to get these pockets now because most pocket breads have milk powder in them.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that's a thing.
Yeah, I mean, bread is definitely, I mean, I feel that as a consumer. I go there and, you know, it's so hard to go and, like, see which ones are vegan or not. Like, you have to go and check the labels and you just bring up your app to go and check all the barcodes and things like that.
Yeah.
So I think bread is a good one. Bread is the challenging also because, like, the shorter the shelf life, the more challenging it is for us. So, like, the whole model is, like, if I do a mass production, I can get the unit cost down and I have to do a big investment up front to get the, you know, large production run, like 4.5 tons. But then once I've got it, I've got 12 months or 18 months to sell that out.
Sure.
And at a low cost because, you know, it's been a big production run.
Yeah.
So I'd like to kind of keep to that model if possible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, yeah, exploring, you know, we're, of course, within confectionery, exploring like a wafer product. So I've got a backwards and forwards on a few prototypes of a chalk wafer.
Well, on that, I noticed yesterday in Springwise that Kit Kat, Japan are the biggest consumers of Kit Kat in the world.
I didn't know that.
I didn't
know. Seriously.
Anyway, but they've also bought it. Anyway, but part of the wrapping now, you can take it off and using origami, turn it into a crane, like a bird.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm not sure how that is sustainable because, you're repurposing into a little origami thing, but that's not. But anyway, they're going from plastic to paper, which, you know, is a move. Yeah. And I think it's quite an engaging move, particularly for that population. You know, origami is a thing. But one of the processes you've demonstrated that is that plant-based food doesn't have to carry a premium price.
Right.
And that's really good. So is this a function of investors riding the vegan wave, seeking a short-term return, unlike yourself, who we might classify as a long-term mission-aligned investor or creator? Or is it a reflection of the subsidies attached to animal agriculture, or is it both?
I think it's a little bit of both. So let's take on the animal product side. Definitely, you know, subsidized and supported by government, you know, taxpayer dollars are going to reducing the price of, you know, or kind of lowering some of the costs associated with production. Mm. And I don't think that's sustainable for, you know, all of the reasons. Like even putting aside the elephant in the room of, you know, animal sentience and the suffering that we're inflicting on them, like just for environmental reasons, like, you know, the planet can't support like, you know, beef consumption and lamb consumption and pork consumption at that sort of like level and dairy consumption at those sort of levels. But when it comes to the pricing on vegan side, I think there's two factors there. One is the economies of scale. So if you're making a radically new process, a radically new formulation, then, you know, you have to go and find someone to make it, and maybe the ingredients are more expensive at the start because you don't have those kind of like, if they're especially exotic ingredients. And so there may be some kind of like cost barriers until you get to a certain level. And I think we're starting to get there. The big producers are starting to get these big economies of scale. And they're also opening up big new factories and, you know, and using their investor money to do that. So I think that price will come down. But what I'm worried about is the other piece, which is like, I don't want vegan to be the same as organic and end up being a permanent, you know, luxury product. And so, for example, there was a plant-based mince that was introduced by one of the large supermarket chains, you know, a year ago. And it was recently rebranded and the price was increased. And I think it was, it's done well and people are willing to buy. And, you know, that's what I worry a bit is like, you know, and I understand like that's value-based pricing. You know, charge what people can afford and don't leave money off on the table and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not good if you're coming at it from a, you know, mission point of view. And so,
which clearly they're not.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think there's good meaning people. You know, within those, and I went in to meet one of the supermarket chains, and this is one thing I can't disclose because, you know, it's confidentiality with them. But they had like vegans on their team and they, you know, well-meaning people who really care about these other issues as well. So I can't say that they don't, they only care about the profits. But the thing is like, we just have to make options available and make sure that there's good, healthy competition so that over time, you know, there will be lower priced, affordable players that everyone can afford, whether you, you know, can live in a nice part of town or whether you're kind of like living in, you know, paycheck to paycheck. So I think that's kind of the ultimate goal. And I should step back. Vegan food is really cheap. In fact, it's the cheapest form of protein on the planet.
Of course it is.
Like if you go and buy, you know, lentils, I mean, that's one of the cheapest, healthiest forms of protein on the planet. Way better than steak or anything else. So it is cheap, but we're talking here about like packaged goods, which is a lot of what people eat today because you know, people are busy and they don't have time to go and, you know, cook and prepare.
Interesting. I spoke to a beef farmer the other day who made the comment that in about a year's time, in his view, beef will be pretty much unaffordable for a lot of people.
Right.
Because of lack of water and subsidies. So interesting space. I think market demands will start to swing the way we might choose it to. It might to a more plant-based approach. So time will tell.
I think it will be cheaper because, I mean, look at beef, for example. It takes 23 calories of feed. Like you have to feed the cow 23 calories to to get one calorie for consumption, human consumption at the end.
It's not a good business model. If you started off with that business model,
that's right.
You wouldn't go there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, on the other hand, I could just go and, you know, take 2 or 3 calories, do a little bit of minimal processing on them, add water, and then I can go and have a very nutritious and now tasty. That wasn't the case 10 years ago, but now it's very tasty.
Yes, yes.
So I think that, look at Hungry Jack's, for example. They just introduced their brand new, like, Rebel Whopper, which is a plant-based
Whopper. I've seen the TVC,
it's a fantastic offering. I had a bite. My wife bought it, and I had a bite, and I was very impressed. And if I'm not wrong, that's priced under the cost of a meat Whopper. And, you know, granted, they may not be at that cost. They may be doing a bit of a loss leader thing at the start, but they're committed to buy a $20 million factory, so, one up. So in Australia, so I think that they're pricing it based on what they know that their costs will be once they're set up.
Interesting.
So that's a really good sign. Like, I think that just the pure maths of it, calories in, calories out, it's going to be much more cheaper. Within 5 years, we're going to have a conversation about plant-based is way cheaper. And then, you know, I think that'll be a wonderful thing because people don't eat meat because of, you know, the slaughter and the suffering and their life, all that sort of problems. They eat it despite that. And so the second you offer them something that tastes as good, it's much better for the environment and the animals, and the price is, you know, competitive or even cheaper, people are going to switch in a big way. So I think there's going to be a radical shift in the next 5 to 10 years.
I think we can see that, yeah.
And the amount of people that nowadays, you know, the increase in health, the decrease in health in terms of stomach issues and whatnot and digestion, and there are so many more people eating plant-based foods due to digestion or health reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And it's interesting. We always assume that it's the young people, you know, people like yourself and, you know, but actually one of the fastest growing kind of segments is actually the baby boomers.
Yeah.
Because they're starting to get older and they're having, you know, I mean, Australia, unfortunately, we're the number one consumption meat, you know, per capita meat consumers in the world, which is a shocking fact.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Number one. And
75% of adults are obese. It goes hand in hand, with only New Zealand actually being worse.
Yeah, I mean, it was just crazy because we think of ourselves as, you know, sunshine, sports and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it's – so I think, like, the older generation is starting to realize and wake up and say, hey, you know, heart disease, blood pressure, diabetes, definitely. Obesity, all of those things are going to, you know, affect a lot of people. And I'm glad that that's starting to spread. And in Australia, we've got a good culture of, you know, some people who are really pushing the, you know, plant-based healthy eating approach and not talking at all about the other issues. I think that's important. Yeah, it's a definite trend there.
As a clearly driven and progressive person, what questions are you currently asking yourself in the face of climate crisis and all that that entails?
Definitely. I mean,
it's very top of mind at the moment, isn't it?
It is. And I came to the, you know, the vegan you know, eating and movement and lifestyle, you know, 10 years ago. And it was for animal reasons. And that is the primary kind of driver for me. But I am seeing, like, because you're in this movement, you see all these people who are very environmentally driven.
Yep.
And now I realize, like, hey, this is also it solves a lot of problems in the world. And specifically, you know, 15 to 20% of greenhouse gas emissions directly come from animal agriculture. That's probably the easiest 20% we could get rid of.
So
like, some of the other stuff like industry and jobs and, you know, transport's a little bit harder to do. But personally, I guess I'm looking at myself and saying, hey, what else can I do? And, you know, things like cutting down transport and because, you know, I've been traveling overseas and I've always get the carbon offset approach. But then now I look into it, it doesn't really like contribute as much. It doesn't really cover the full costs of it. So trying to cut down travel and trying to, and for Bite Society, you know, looking at things like, okay, what's the efficient ways to do these things?
Yeah.
And like storage, like we have a second batch being made and we want to sell it overseas. We're talking to a few countries like Germany and UK and others in early discussions. But where do we store it? Like, do we make it? Do we ship it over to Australia because it's a centralized kind of like storage base and then send it out from there? But what about the carbon miles? So starting to go through those calculations and thinking.
Martin and I quite like a saying by Mark Twain, which is good decisions come from experience. Experience comes from making bad decisions.
Yep.
To go back in time, what advice would you give to your younger self?
That's a good question. I think, well, I don't have any real regrets. I think that, you know, the path I've taken made lots of mistakes, but, you know, on the positive side, I've kind of gained up experience and also resources. I mean, I've been working for, you know, working for employers and live fairly frugally. And so I've kind of like got some personal savings that I can use now to go and start these projects. I think that's on the positive side. I'd say the advice would be to go and be entrepreneurial a bit earlier. And you don't have to go and leave your day job. So I still work a day job, by the way. So I still work in a software company, Frenzu, which is I co-founded, but I'm no longer the CEO of.
Yep.
I still have a day job and I still kind of do that and that pays the bills. But I'm doing Bite Society basically as a passion project at nights and weekends and doing that. So actually there's no full-time employees within Bite Society. So we've managed to kind of get this off the ground with just part-time and collaborators.
Yeah.
So I would say, like, you know, and this is general advice to myself, but also to young people, it's like you don't need to go and quit your job to go and have an impact.
No.
You know, start up a passion project, something you really believe in or you want to go and contribute that's not necessarily about money, and go and start that thing up. And then see where it goes. And these days you can. Like, it's very easy to go and, like, there's a lot of resources and help that you can go and get something off the ground. Whereas maybe 20 years ago without the internet, without, you know, a lot of things, it was a lot harder to do.
And that's sort of the misunderstanding, isn't it? You sort of think to have a startup or to start up your own passion point or business or whatever that may be, it's quit your day job and devote 24/7, you know, all your hours into it, when really – sometimes that can be quite unrealistic, you know, keep your day job and do this outside of that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's, you know, I wouldn't like risk everything. And if you've got like a, you know, you've got to also can gain experience as well as like having the financial resources from working in a company. Mm-hmm. I mean, but it's also a very risky thing. So I would say like try to get the best of both worlds, you know, get the experience, but like lower the risk profile until you're at the point where if you've got something really taking off, then go for it and jump onto it.
And it's an interesting balance between following your passion versus following what you're good at, because they're not necessarily the same thing.
Right.
No. And listening to someone like Tim Ferriss, he would generally say, do what you're good at.
Right.
Because following a passion might come as a result of that. But if you follow a passion, I want to become the next Jacques Cousteau, or I want to, you know, blah, whatever. It's not likely to happen. But if I not stick to what I'm good at, but begin with what I'm good at, then who knows where that, as you say, where that might go.
I think so. I think that, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but I do think it's true. Like, if you're passionate about what you do, then you don't treat it as work. You just treat it as like every day I wake up and I'm like, cool, I get to work on these things. And I do my gratitude journal in the morning and I'm like, wow, I get to work on this. It's really cool. I'm excited. Even the grindy stuff, I'm like, okay, yeah, I get through it. But, you know, this is towards a really cool kind of goal.
Mm.
So I think passion is important. But the good thing is that, and I've been reading up on this, there's a lot of research that you can go and develop passions. Like, passions can be learned and they can be kind of like grown in this like specific ways. I'm reading a book called Grit by Angela Duckworth. And she talks about like the research into this, which is like you can actually go and encourage and spark and learn passion in a way. Mm. And I think that's probably the most important life kind of like lesson that I'm taking on board is like, because sometimes you just have to do things which are not very fun and not very exciting, and you've got to do that. But you can kind of like trigger some sort of like purpose or mission, you know, into that work. Even if it's just for the purely like, I have to get through this so I can earn money so I can do something that I really am passionate about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even that, you can kind of like build and kind of get through that.
Yeah, you can balance that.
But yeah, like if you've got two jobs and you're passionate about one, then go for that. Some people are really passionate about accounting and finance and you know, doing things efficiently. And that's great. Not one of them, but, you know. So I think that, there's a lot of – that's my – I would encourage that back to the, you know, young people.
Yeah.
I would encourage people to kind of like learn about how to develop passions because I think that can help it supercharge their interest in, in a particular area.
Mm. So Elias, you need – Get a copy of Grit.
Yes, I will. I will.
Sure. Get into that. Seth Godin, we've already mentioned him once, but he has a view that what matters is doing work that matters for people that care. Now, without question, you are doing work that matters for people that care. You have a community of people who've followed you and gone through your pains and your ups. what's your view on the matters doesn't matter ratio out there, in terms of there are a lot of people doing stuff that with the state of the planet, the state of the nation, you kind of wonder, it doesn't matter what you're doing versus it does matter what you're doing. What kind of balance would you, in your view? I mean, we're not attacking anyone. We're just simply having a think about, could more people be doing more stuff that matters for people that care?
Yes, we absolutely need that. Now, you know, the young people, the young generations, they're already doing more than, you know, people of, you know, baby boomer age. I mean, we'll just be frank about it. Like, they care more about it. They're more socially aware. And we've seen the huge positive changes in things like, you know, social acceptance of gay marriage and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think, you know, they do care, but it's the rate of change and the rate of people actually acting is way, way under what we actually need. Like, at the moment, thank goodness we have people like Bill Gates and, you know, and some very influential and powerful and rich people who have put a lot of money into these sort of like topics, but they're just like, you know, a small number of people. We need everyone kind of like involved in a way. And, and I think that, you know, it's maybe it's an old fashioned thing about like, you know, if we grew up in villages and, you know, we all have to help out in the village to go and, you know, to survive together. And it's not just looking after yourself, you know? And I think that that has to translate because, look, I mean, if no other reason, it's just the climate crisis. I mean, literally millions of people are starting to die. I mean, people don't realize, they think, oh, it's just, you know, hot weather or whatever. I mean, millions of people are starting to die from, you know, civil wars, which are triggered by climate change, and from, you know, mass migrations, which are, you know, going to happen. Mm. And so I think that even though, you know, we may be comfortable here in our lives, but, you know, the world's going to get a whole lot worse if we kind of continue on the way we're going. So yes, we need, you know, especially the younger generations to kind of like do more than previous generations and to go and make those changes. Mm. And I'm not speaking as a blanket thing for everyone. Of course, there's people who care, but yeah, we need to change that ratio and quickly.
And I think Greta's doing a good job there in terms of bringing it to people's attention. Mm. We won't get into XR and all that. That's not why we're here, but that's another discussion.
Right.
Which is, you know, very evident and present. And can be scary if you really want to follow it through.
Yeah, exactly. And the scary thing is that the powers, you know, who have vested interest in keeping things the way they are, they're starting to put, you know, serious money to go and, you know, have disinformation. And you saw the, you know, large businesswoman putting in like $4.5 million to go and fund climate denial projects. So I think that, there's a challenge of our times, and this is the big challenge of our generation.
Indeed
and
it is.
I think people are standing up for it now.
I think we agree. So as we wrap up, you've mentioned one book, Grit, but are there any podcasts or books that you think might enrich the lives of our listeners?
Absolutely. I'm a huge podcast junkie. I listen every day. So there's several good ones that I like. One is called 80,000 Hours. Mm-hmm. And this is something which is part of the effective altruism movement. And it talks about, in your career, you basically will work for 80,000 hours. Like, what is the most high impact way to have a positive, you know, a positive effect on the world with those 80,000 hours? So it talks about, you know, different career choices and, you know, how you can, you know, do your work. Should you be an entrepreneur or should you just work in an investment bank and earn a lot of money so the money can go to really good causes? Mm-hmm. That's great. There's one called EA Radio, Effective Altruism Radio.
Okay.
And that has real deep dives into kind of things like, you know, what's the highest impact of, you know, what you can do with your money to have the biggest impact. So for example, like malaria is still one of the top things. Like buying bed nets is still one of the most effective.
Right.
You can save a life with $3,000. That's the calculation. Mm-hmm. So if you have $3,000, you could go on a holiday or you could go and save a life with that. So I really like it because it's kind of like appeals to my engineering side, really analyzing that. And there's plenty in the vegan space. There's, you know, Eat for the Planet podcast, which is wonderful. Interviews a lot of like Beyond Meat CEO and other folks like that, and Vegan Business Talk. So there's a huge long list. If anyone wants to ask me, they can get in touch by email, and I would love to go and, you know, share some suggestions.
Very good. Also, I noticed on your, I think it was the website, that you're saying if anybody's got any ideas or wants to have any kind of startup along these lines, then please contact me. So you've made yourself so very available. And to that end, I'd love thank you. Big thank you for being here today, Simon. We really, really appreciate your time and energy and your thoughts. And we'll call it a day at that point.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Cheers. For more information about Simon's journey and Bite Society, you can go to bitesociety.com.